You're listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Today's episode, Ed Murgatroyd.
You know, lawyers have to walk the line every day between what they can do, they can't do, what they can say, they can't do, they can say this, that, there's discovery, there's also... Money people are not like that. One might add some of like hedge funds, are they even held to account? And what I would ask myself if I were a in-house counsel going to a firm that was not owned by the lawyers is, who gets brought to task if you do something unethical?
Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Harrity, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. After you're done listening to this episode, please leave us a review wherever you're listening now and give us a 5-star rating. It really helps others find the show. Thank you. And now here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by Ed Murgatroyd. If the name Murgatroyd sounds familiar, it's probably because it's the name of one of the largest IP law firms in Europe. The firm was founded by Ed's dad, Ian Murgatroyd, and Ed worked there for more than 20 years. He was the CEO of a firm, but left 3 years after it was acquired by a private equity firm. Yes, a law firm acquired by a private equity firm, a concept that is probably foreign to most American lawyers. Ed is now the CEO of Hexus IP, a disruptive tech-based global renewals and annuity services company based in the U.S., a subject that I haven't thought much about, but after talking to Ed, I think it's really quite fascinating, the business aspect of it. I want to thank Ken Robbins, who is also at Murgatroyd, but is now the CEO of Hexus IP, for helping make this interview happen. Ken has been telling me for a while that I should interview Ed, but I thought Kent might be a little biased and was skeptical. But I fortunately got a chance to talk with Ed myself recently. He's truly one of the most interesting and sincere people I've met in IP and has a ton of great ideas and stories to share. So I'm really excited to share our conversation today. Ed, thank you so much for joining Clause 8.
Oh, thank you, Eli. Appreciate it.
I mentioned your dad was a patent attorney, but do you remember when you first were aware of what a patent was?
So our family story really goes along the line of, I was in my dad's office before I was even born, because my mother tells how she was hanging curtains in his office while she was heavily pregnant with me. So I like to think I've been in patents since I was, before I was even born. I don't know that I really understood what it was until probably high school. I didn't really know. I think one time I asked my dad, what is it that you do? And he said, I guess I write letters, you know, like this is what I do most of the day. But he was an engineer.
I've been looking for a good way to explain it to my kids, but I haven't stumbled there.
It's quite, you know, you can kind of go down into a dark rabbit hole if you start trying to explain it too much to kids. Basically, you know, he was a mechanical engineer, got into patents in one way or another. The story he always liked to tell was, because the carpet manufacturer that he worked for, they had to come up with a carpet that would expand for the Concorde. Yeah. This was, you know, I guess people freaked out the first time they were on Concorde, and when it goes supersonic, it became longer, but the carpet didn't become longer. So people under their feet, just the carpet started, you know, separating, and people did not like that. Yeah. So they had to work on an innovation for that. And he just really loved innovation, but he also entered the IP market in the UK, particularly in the 70s, when it was still very staid and old, and he used to call it was full of dusty books.
People might be able to guess you're from Scotland.
That's right. Sorry, I should have put a warning out in advance.
But, people don't usually associate, and no offense, with Scotland being a hotbed of innovation or patents. But your dad did start his firm there. As you said, he was at a carpet company. But what made him, I guess, start his own firm? Was that?
Yeah, I think he, there was a guy in a in-house department who basically encouraged my dad, and in fact seed funded him to become a patent attorney. And that he enticed him away. He'd trained at a long established firm, which interestingly he ended up going on and buying that firm years in the future, which he always would tell that story with a slight chuckle and a grin, because
what was the name of the firm?
It was called Fitzpatrick's. Yeah. And because when he left there, they were not happy with him. So, you know, he went off and started his own thing.
Not happy because of the work he was doing, or because of the...
How dare he
leave
and start his own firm? Yeah. Because there was at that time really just, I think, two firms, Fitzpatrick's and Marks and Clark, who were called Cruikshank and Fairweather back then, for anyone listening that remembers that. So he started his own firm, but he really started it to be an extension of an in-house department. He always would tell us, you know, make sure you respond to clients while they still remember what the question was that they asked. Because at that point, I think, it could take months to get a patent application. It would, and then he also would tell me, make sure the first line of your letter tells the client what the answer is. Wow. Don't wait till the end. Don't sneak it in the middle. Have all the documenting behind, but clients don't care about that. Yeah. Ultimately, they just want to know what should we be doing. Yeah. So he always tried to give good practical advice that people could take, and I think that really rubbed off on both the firm and the culture, and certainly on me in my life.
You mentioned somebody seeded that firm. Who was that?
I think his name was called Jack Andrews. He was just some dude, and he gave my dad £5,000.
Was he a lawyer or a businessman?
No, just a businessman who just wanted, I don't know. You know, my dad ended up buying him out years later, but he was kind of a mystery figure. And as you know, as a child growing up, because there's this like benefactor that gave my dad money, because, you know, my mum and dad did not come from any money.
Yeah.
Literally, my dad was self-made.
Not a long line of IP attorneys now.
No, not at all. Not at all. Although my grandfather was, he worked for Dunlop in the tire business and rubber.
Yeah.
And so I think my dad had a really strong foundation in engineering.
Yeah.
And he certainly, well, he picked, I did mechanical engineering, and I'm not kidding, he said, I didn't know what to do at college. And he said, well, if you really don't know what to do, I did mechanical engineering, you can just do mechanical engineering. And I think that's how that actually happened.
You know, you mentioned your dad's, I guess he wanted to be, Murgatroyd to be an extension of in-house departments. Who were his initial clients? How did that develop?
You know, he kept the first letter that he ever wrote in his new firm. He typed it himself. I think it went in... You know, he's passed away now, I should say. And I think that did land in my sister's house or somewhere. But he did a lot of work for the Scotch whiskey business. He really enjoyed that. He really did. And he did, there was a big drinks company called Scottish Newcastle.
Yeah.
And he really, that was a foundational a client. And I think also he did a lot for Milliken here in South Carolina. So he was doing the European work for them. Some great stories. He interestingly always told me, never allow your clients, one client, to be more than 5% of your business. It's too risky.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in those early years, he brought two other business partners in. So he sold them 25% and 15% partners. So he was always in charge fully. And that was the sort of big character that he was. Yeah. He ran it his way. Very fair, but very firm is what I would describe his business acumen.
You mentioned, you know, he had some local clients. He had one client in the U.S. He brought in some partners. When did it really start to grow?
I won't lie. There was some years when I was a teenager where I remember him sitting down, and anyone who runs their own firm, or is not even just firm, but anyone who runs their own business knows these conversations. You know, had the family sit down at Christmas time and be like, look, this is, you know, this isn't going to be a huge Christmas this year.
Yeah.
You know, things are tight. And that was really when the European patent really was kicking off. There was a lot of anxiety in the industry in the UK as to, should we hire people? What should we, is this going to affect us? Are we going to like lose a lot of business? And then I think at some point, this is a sort of little known fact that Margaret Thatcher, who was the Prime Minister of the UK at the time, was actually, I can't remember if she was actually a patent attorney or she, there was something anyway, and she knew the industry very well. And she sort of threatened to maybe undo the patent system at one point.
Yeah.
And that caused absolute panic, as you would imagine, across the industry.
In the UK.
Yeah. Just it seemed anti-competitive or something.
Yeah.
So it never happened, of course. Yeah. But so there was a large period in the UK where nobody got trained as a patent attorney. So there was this huge skills gap, which became really important later on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when my dad was looking for succession planning, wasn't really as many people coming up through, and finding patent attorneys was the biggest challenge. That one of the biggest challenges we faced at Murgatroyd was finding good attorneys.
What changed? Your dad, it obviously started growing at one point. What was the?
I would say, from my perspective, it changed probably in the early 90s. You know, that kind of boom.
Yeah.
That's really when it changed, I would say. And we opened our first satellite office, we called it, in Aberdeen, Scotland, which is the big oil capital for Britain. And then, you know, my dad actually went on a huge world trip to China, Japan, the US. He was away for it. I mean, we kind of went with him, but we never saw him. And he picked up a lot of agency work.
Okay.
And that's really when things turned for us.
So what was the size of the firm, I guess, when he's starting? How many attorneys at that point?
Gosh, not many. Okay. I mean, I think it was like my dad and his two partners, and maybe each of them had a trainee, or like a kind of more senior trainee.
Okay, so it was very small.
I mean, still really small, but then it grew quite quickly.
So your dad, you know, he said, how do I get more work? He's going on this global trip. And it's interesting because what Murgatroyd eventually became was, correct me if I'm wrong, but almost a hub for companies and law firms that want to file, pursue patent protection all over the world, and they just go through Murgatroyd, which has all these contacts with foreign firms, which I guess some of those relationships started probably with your dad. How did that come about? How did you guys become almost the hub for that?
Yeah, so it started with my father deciding that he wanted to expand into Europe. And the reason for that was he had won these Japanese clients, he'd won these US clients, and they all needed sort of cross Europe help.
Yeah.
And he was kind of getting frustrated at having to outsource that all the time, be it the validation stage or whatever it was, he was just frustrated. So he, when the European Union came around, he was quite excited about this, but it took a long time. And eventually he opened up in France.
Okay.
And the reason we did that was because there was one client there that we serviced.
Yeah.
So we thought, well, why not be close to them? We got a tremendous pushback from the industry in France and in Ireland when we opened there as well.
Yeah.
At that point, they were still like, you cannot practice here because you're not Irish or French.
And at that point, the European patent already existed.
The European patent office was there and we were doing that. And long story short, he threatened to take them to the European Court of Justice and say, well, you can't stop us from like being here. So eventually did that. He broke that barrier. He was the first to really expand amongst Europe.
Yeah.
And then it was really in 2007, fast forward,
and
when...
And at that stage, did he ever think of, well, maybe we should merge with... Maybe we should acquire some local firm. Like, why? What was that decision?
We did. So the first acquisition happened shortly thereafter in France.
Oh, okay.
Just down the road, there was another guy who had a small practice, and that was our first foray into acquisitions. Whilst I was there, we did 5 acquisitions. But always interesting. The main driving force for that, again, coming back to, that we couldn't find good attorneys.
Yeah.
So you kind of had to buy your way into getting attorneys. That's changed now. I mean, it's not the same.
Yeah.
But at the time, that was really critical. So we were able to access large numbers of good attorneys at that point.
I'm guessing that's part of the story because you guys are doing all this European work. You have this relationships with clients who need it all over the world, and you are naturally doing that. I mean, you said it's hard to find attorneys. It was even hard to find good attorneys in Europe. What about finding a good attorney in China, for example, or Korea? How did you do that?
We bucked the trend a little bit, because the trend back when my father was coming through the industry was you get into bed with a foreign attorney and you send each other's work.
Yeah.
My dad just never subscribed to that. He didn't like it. He felt it was anti-client.
Yeah, and just so people know, there's actually apps now. But attorneys who work at firms like that, they can keep track of who's sending them what.
And, and I am firmly of the belief, whenever the client does not become the center of your world, kind of like a doctor, you want the doctor to view you as the most important thing. Yeah. You want to know your attorney, any attorney, patent attorney in this case, that you are their number one concern for decision making. The problem lies with these reciprocal relationships. Firstly, they're normally clandestine. So the client themselves don't know that their work is being used as a lever to obtain other work.
Yeah.
There are no price drivers because one could argue the price drivers are anti, which is, why don't we just charge each other a lot more?
Yeah.
So that was never good. And really we approached those when we needed somebody in China to do work. Literally, my father had visited people. He had a great network. But he would say to them, we need a good price. We need to know you do a good job and we need a good price.
Yeah.
And those two things went hand in hand. He would apply pressure on them sometimes and say, hey, how come you don't send us anything? Do you not think we do good work at a good price? But it was that sort of discussion. It wasn't this reciprocal relationship thing, which we didn't like. So that really stood us in good stead when we decided, and this is the little secret. Why did we come to the US? Well, yes, it was a good opportunity, but also I married an American and we had two kids and we wanted to come back to the States to be near to my wife's parents. Yeah. So when that came up, I sat down with my dad in his apartment. I'm like, hey, Dad, have we ever thought of going to the US? And he's like, no, never. We're never going to compete with U.S. attorneys.
We'll get to that part of the story. I guess I'm still want to talk about the foreign aspect. So one thing is that your dad really relied on these personal relationships to kind of meet these attorneys. But one thing that's hard, I guess, is evaluating a foreign attorney's work, right? Because first of all, it might be in a foreign language. The way things work in a different country, the way the patent office works, obviously the rules and the laws are different, is all different. Any thoughts about that? How do you evaluate, how did your dad make those judgments about, well, that is a good attorney, we can trust him for our clients? Any thoughts about that?
I think honestly, when he first started, before he had that wealth of knowledge built up for himself by prosecuting cases in those countries, I think he probably just lent, my gut would be that he just leaned on the relationships he used when he was at Fitzpatrick's,
okay.
Which is they were long established and they were in this agent reciprocation game. So I think they sort of knew. Of course, when you're litigating something or you're prosecuting in a foreign country, even though it is very different, there's some baseline things that come out quite quickly. Even if it's just the fact that they're having to translate. Everything my dad did was always in English. He just required that. Yeah. Even when we went to France or wherever, it was always, the work was done in English. So, barring awful kind of, I suppose, fraud that could happen, barring that, you just take the translation and you see whether or not what they're arguing makes sense. Because a lot of the concepts and patents, as globally are very similar. No. The way they're applied can be slightly different.
That's true,
But they're pretty similar.
It's very easy to spot when things don't quite make sense. From a business perspective, I guess, so I kind of talked about how your firm became a hub, but it's different kind of work, right? In terms of your dad, here he was, he had these Scottish companies. He was preparing applications for themselves. And, you know, it grew kind of like that versus Firm, where, you know, you're, a lot of the work is administrative, right? Sending things in and out and so forth. I mean, from a business perspective, how did you and your dad kind of think about that?
Me and my dad were very aligned on this. We knew that customer service was, it's just the old adage, you know, customer service is really important. And also people work with lawyers they like.
Yeah.
So, you know, we always took a very strong approach on quality of the work.
Yeah.
But by and large, every patent attorney and firm have pretty good work. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to become a patent attorney.
Yeah.
You know, these are really intelligent people who spend years of their life becoming a patent attorney. The quality across the board is something I'm quite proud of as a patent attorney. When you see other industries and you see how there's like fly by night and there's, you know, even in say the personal injury, you know, people that there's quality levels. And of course there's quality that goes between, you know, the different firms in the States or in Europe or whatever. But by and large, you're arguing over the top 5%. Like, is someone slightly better or slightly worse? So, you know, from that point of view, we just liked to not compete so much just on that, but also try and compete and be the best at the customer service side. It's one of the reasons we came to the US, not to take US work, but to take European work that was being generated by US companies, because why wouldn't you be closer to where your client is?
You met your wife in the US and you came to your dad with the idea of expanding in the US, but what made you even want to join the family business at that point?
Oh, right. Oh, gosh. Well, I didn't want to join the family business at the start. After I left university, I went to University of Glasgow. I went to Australia with my plans that a lot of my family was out there, and I was going to go into banking. This was what I wanted to do because I thought that seemed really cool. After about a month working in banking, I realized it was very, very repetitive and boring to me.
Yeah.
No offense to any bankers, if that's your thing, but I love innovation and entrepreneurialism and all of that. This was not for me. After a year, my dad had said he wanted me to go into the firm at the very start. He said, well, I've got a job for you to train as a patent attorney. And I said, well, no, I don't know, thanks. After about 6 months, I'm like, hey, is that job still? There's still a chance I could come back and get that job. He's like, well, we'll see. Yeah. And he put me with one of his partners, a chap named Paolo Pacitti, who was just incredible, like incredible.
But when you were growing up, was that the expectation that he always had? I think
in his head, yes. Because, you know, my sister became a trademark attorney.
Yeah.
and she is not practicing anymore either. So I think, you know, if you asked her, I don't know if she would say, was that just making sure? He loved it. Within our family dining room table conversation, you know, the business was, my mom would say, well, that's your first and most important child. Because, you know, he loved the firm. He loved his firm. Absolutely. And he really sacrificed a lot to make it what it was. And I think his expectation he wanted me and my sister to enter the firm and take it on.
Yeah.
By that point, the firm had moved from a partnership, I think in the late 90s, I might get that slightly wrong, but late 90s, I think they moved from a partnership to a limited liability company. And that was, they were the first to do that. I think that was when the law changed, they were allowed to do that. And then 2001, we decided to float the business.
You coming to the US, right? That happened before.
No, so that happened in 2007.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Okay. So you joined the firm, and then by float the business, I think it became publicly listed on the London Stock Exchange. How did that come about?
So that was hilarious in a way. I mean, sadly, hilarious. I mean, we're sitting here in DC today, and we on the way here I passed the Pentagon, and we were actually just discussing because Kent, you know, was in the services, and he had been in the Pentagon, and we were talking about 9/11. Very sad, of course. We had already committed to floating the company in November of 2001.
But what made you want to do that?
Okay, yeah. We needed to. It was quite easy. We needed to. There was two partners that wanted to kind of cash out.
Okay.
And as you know, owning a there's very, very limited options if you've built value.
Yeah.
And it's a very knife-edge decision between the firm being an asset or an albatross around your neck. Because what do you do with it? Like what, you know, my dad was eight, starting to get older. And he's like, well, I either give it to my kids, but they have to be attorney, like you have to be patent attorneys and whatever. Or we need to find, there's this new thing coming through where potentially we could have outside money come in and pay out those two partners. My dad had no interest in cashing out at this point. He was like, no, I'm all in.
So was that a common thing that was happening? Firms get...
No, he was the first and only to have done it.
Okay.
Three actually more did it in Australia in the years following. And two of them have now combined. So there's now two publicly traded companies.
He was just looking for a way to cash out these partners and occurred to him, we could become a publicly...
You know, my dad always surrounded himself. This was an adage of his. He said, always surround yourself with people more intelligent than you in business. And he had great advisors.
Yeah.
And they suggested to him, well, you do know there's what was called ABS, alternative business structures, have passed as a law.
Yeah.
It's possible that you could list this. And, you know, my dad was just that type of guy. He's like, let's do it.
Did you have any concerns? Did your mom have any concerns about this completely new...
My dad had concerns. We all didn't know we were stepping forth into brand new territory. Nobody knew what this would be like. And Eli, I remember the day we listed.
Yeah.
And me and my dad, you know, you're sitting there and at 9 a.m. Well, you were saying
you were talking about September 11th and then November. And then
September the 11th. Yeah. So, you know, that happened in September. You can imagine we were about to float on the first, I think it was the 1st of November.
Yeah.
We were all the way down the line. We had everything ready. And September 11th happened, and, you know, all the lawyers call us in. They're like, you know, you're not going to want to do this now. I mean, the markets are in turmoil. But, you know, my dad is like, you know, you got to keep going.
Yeah.
Life's got to go on. We'll just keep going. And in reality, we'd gone so far down the line financially doing this deal.
Yeah.
It would have been awful to terminate it. So the slight asterisk I would put at the end of Murgatroyd was a publicly traded company was when we went public, our family still owned over 50% of the shares. And anyone who deals in public stuff, public companies, knows anything over 25% is effective control of a publicly traded company. Yeah. So that's where I would just, you know, if we do get on to talk about, you know, alternative ownership structures in the States, It's something that must be borne in mind when looking at the Murgatroyd case study.
Yeah.
It was still run by really my father at the time, then me and my father, who were both patent attorneys.
Yeah.
And we had sounds awful, but we had the iron fist. We could decide yes or no.
Yeah.
And we often did around the boardroom.
And was the fact that it was publicly listed that it impact you in any way? Like, was the stock price
volatile? Oh, we would watch it, you know, for the first month, you watched it every minute.
Yeah.
And then I remember at the end of the first day when it was traded, and, you know, it was hardly traded because we had institutions, the Murgatroyd family, there was a tiny amount of what they call retail investors, which would be, you know, somebody just going on, there wasn't Robin Hood at the time, but something like that. It was very hard to get your hands on Murgatroyd shares. So that's another slight weird thing about it. It was, but at the end of that day, you know, me and my dad, I went into his office and I'm like, so I guess we're publicly traded. How did it go? And he was like, don't know. I mean, a bit of a letdown. Like, I thought something would feel different, but yet here we are just doing exactly the same thing. We're getting patent applications out. We're dealing with foreign agents. He said, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So I think it caught us all off guard a little bit. We thought it was going to be this big dramatic thing.
Yeah.
And in reality, it was not, because we weren't cashing out at that point. Okay. So it wasn't like a big check arrived or anything. It was just business as usual, I would say.
You joined the firm, it gets publicly listed. How was it working with your dad? You know, your dad has been doing it for a long time before you joined.
I loved every minute of it. We actually had offices across from each other.
Okay.
And why that was probably annoying for him, but not for me, is I just listened all the time to every conversation. He would leave his door open,
yeah,
and we were up in this like little separated area.
Yeah.
And the amount I learned, you know, like just his business brain was off the charts. I mean, just how he would look at things and negotiate deals or navigate challenges. You know, every firm has its challenges, right? And I got the joyous opportunity, really, looking back now that he's passed away, of being able to sit for hours and hours and hours on end with my father across from me,
yeah,
and listen to how his brain worked. And it brought us really close. We're a really, really close family. My sister, she ended up leaving the profession when she had her kids, but she was still very engaged in what I would call bigger family decisions about the firm.
Yeah.
You know, when we were deciding to do something,
yeah,
we would get round our dinner table, yeah, to discuss it. My mum used to come in and say, right, that's it. No more talking about Murgatroyd.
Yeah.
And that would be our signal that it was time to talk about, you know, other stuff.
You shared some of your dad's lessons about being a good attorney, but any business lessons about running a firm that stand out to you that I guess you learned from listening to those conversations that he had?
Well, you know, there's a letter, if I don't know if you can attach it to, yeah, the bottom of the podcast, but I can send it to you. Business Insider did this letter where they asked my father to write a letter to his younger self.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So in fact, yeah, it is immortalized. His advice is immortalized in this letter.
That's amazing.
And I have it in my office, actually. Oh, wow. Up on the wall. Yeah. This article, he always says never sell an asset. You know, I think his thing was never sell an asset. Now I would probably flex that a little and say, well, but he did sell assets all the time. He just knew when to sell. You know, if something was good, one of the big lessons he taught me was, you know, try something. Never be afraid to try.
Yeah.
But never be afraid to turn around and run. Like, you know, so try it, but yeah, don't just keep hitting your head against, yeah, the brick wall. If it's not working, exit. And a great example of that was when we opened in Japan.
Yeah.
We thought it was a great idea. They had the horrific earthquake and tsunami.
Yeah.
Everything went on hold. We closed it, we took our losses, and we turned around.
Yeah.
Because there was no point in keeping going at something that's not working. Yeah. So, you know, I think that's a great general life advice for me, which in business particularly, you know, you try things, you have to be able to say no to things. You know, I've learned that at my new company, Hexos. Yeah. You know, you get pulled in a million directions.
Yeah.
You have to stay focused. And he was excellent at that. He used to talk about, he would come into the firm and drive everyone nuts because, you know, he would just appear in a meeting that he wasn't probably invited to. And he used to call it lifting rocks to look underneath them.
Yeah.
Because he knew he couldn't look under every rock in the firm.
Yeah.
But he knew if he just randomly selected one and look under it. And what he meant by looking under the rock was digging in, like, what's happening with, yeah, this? And if he did that enough, it reminded everybody that people care. There's someone here who cares about this.
Yeah.
You have to do your best. But he never got annoyed. He only would get annoyed at colleagues if they didn't do something, if they didn't even try. Yeah. You know, the thing that drove him the most mad was people washing their hands of things. Like, that's not my area, or that's not my circus. He was like, no, everything is your circus. You might not know, you might not be the one to solve it, but always try. Do so. You won't get into trouble for doing your best and trying, but you will get into trouble in this firm if you turn a blind eye, or, you know.
Yeah.
And that went down to, me and my sister were just discussing this last week, it went down to, like, I'm looking around this room that we're doing the podcast in. He would notice every detail. Like, if there was something slightly off, or a picture frame slightly off, yeah, he would fix it, or he would ask somebody, hey, there's a little bit of paint there that needs fixed.
Yeah.
So, and that's the approach he took to everything, be it building the firm and the quality, making sure that we had the best attorneys, making sure we had the best processes. He was one of the first to get an ISO certification because he wanted everything in the firm quality assured and written down and documented.
Yeah.
And that was an enormous undertaking. Every year you had to do it, you had to keep up to date.
What is ISO?
ISO is a global accreditation. They do it for all sorts of things, but the one they did was for like procedures.
Okay, okay.
So everything at Murgatroyd, I don't know if they still do it, honestly, I've not been there, but their ISO certification was very important to us because it meant that we could run all our offices homogeneously.
Yeah.
Down to the carpets. My father would put the same carpet in every office, even if it meant it was a Milliken carpet.
Did he use that carpet company that he used to work
yes.
for?
Yes. No, he used Milliken, right, which was another client.
Yeah.
But he would ship these stinking carpet tiles, honestly. Like, and nobody, I didn't love them. Yeah. But anyway, and in fact, when I opened up the US office for Murgatroyd, I put my foot down. I said, we are not having that carpet. My dad was furious at me. He's like, that carpet is in every, and I said, Dad, it's old. So I got something very similar.
You mentioned you came to your dad after you were already there. You said how closely, but your wife's family's from America, so you decided to move to North Carolina, I believe. Was this after or before the Japan experience? I'm curious.
Japan happened while we were in the States.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess what was your vision? Were you nervous? Like,
Yeah. I you know, one thing about the Murgatroyds, me and my dad, were very headstrong visionaries. So we had a vision as to what we wanted. So once my dad got over the fact that I was leaving for America, and that took 2 weeks, you know, off, and he was really mad about it. He's like, what? No, you're taking my grandkids. But we got over it. And then we started getting our heads together, like, right, how do we build an awesome business in the US? And we put out a plan. And I literally came over, I went into what was called a Regis office. It's like a WeWork, but not fun. So went to Regis. I got a windowless room, literally, just me. I hired a guy straight out of college to help me. And, you know, my dad will say, just went over with a laptop. And literally, that's what I did. And it took, everyone who ever comes to the US, you know, in some of my...
But you had some clients here already, or was it...
Very few.
Okay, very few.
Not tiny.
Okay.
You know, I know the stat because it's one that we tracked. But when I came, I think it was just under 5% of global revenues were coming from the US. When the time I left, it was over almost 60%.
Yeah, wow.
So it was a dramatic, but the first 3 years, no, nothing. There was so many times I questioned myself. I was like, am I wasting my time? Why am I doing this? You know, we came up against a lot of initial resistance from US attorneys thinking that we were entering their market.
Yeah.
So I'd say the first 3 years was convincing them of the truth, which was we had no interest in doing any US work whatsoever. Yeah. We were your partner. And it really wasn't, honestly, it wasn't until anyone who follows this might know the Murgatroyd Group, but a chap, Jamie Lelever, who I teamed up with him and brought him in to professionalize the sales and marketing.
Yeah.
Because I realized that we had a sales and marketing problem, particularly marketing. We had to show that Murgatroyd was not a US firm. We might be in the US, but we're not a US firm.
Two things. One is, you know, you mentioned one of your dad's business advice is you try something and you cut and run. What's he saying during those 3 years?
So the 3 years, how often did we decide to cut and run? I thought about it probably more than my dad did. It was really his perseverance that kept us going for those 3 years because there was many times I said, Dad, look, I don't know if this is working. Like,
Do you think it's because he knew like this is where you wanted to be and kind of make that happen, or...
I think, dare I say, I sold him so well on the idea that he really believed in it by that point. He's like, no, it makes complete sense. Like, at that point, if you looked at who was filing European patents, half of European patents were filed by Europeans. But that meant in all of those countries dispersed, 30%, might even have been more than that, might have been like 38%, was filed by US companies. Yeah. So I remember the day that I showed Dad that chart, and he's like, oh, well, that makes absolute sense. Go where the clients are. And I think he really believed in it. And he would just say, patience, patience, patience. I was also at the same time still doing work for the UK firm. So I felt very privileged and blessed to be able to do this here with my family, near their family and all of that. And at the same time, still be working for a well-capitalized, great firm.
Yeah.
And I did try to keep costs down. You know, I did. But, you know, at the end of the day, I came up with a plan and said, this is how much I think it's going to cost us to get from A to B.
From what I gather is, you know, your dad kind of built the firm in Europe based on personal relationships, and then it kind of grew and grew. Here it seems, you know, I'm sure you had some relationships, but what was your first step? You know, like you hired this guy from, you said a recent college grad, but like, who are you contacting? How are you contacting them?
We picked some local events.
Yeah.
Actually, we picked one event in Raleigh where we were.
Okay.
With the view that if, you know, we cannot, and this was really joint effort with me and this chap, Jamie, if we can't convince people in Raleigh, then we should just close it down and leave.
Okay.
Right? Why try and convince someone in California? We can't even convince someone outside our front door.
But who are you, where was the event? Was it an IP event?
It was called CED. Which is Council for Entrepreneurial Development. They're still around. And they were hosting a tech conference.
Yeah.
And we took a booth and we organized, and it was not easy to do, I discovered later, but we organized a Scotch tasting.
Okay.
And then there was a great chap called Bill Barrett, who's a US attorney, who wrote a book about IP.
Yeah.
And we brought him along and he did a book signing. That's all we did, a Scotch, book signing, and a booth. And that's where it started. That's where we started.
Hearing that story, you know, most people at a conference, I'm guessing, probably don't even know anything about patents, right? So not only have you had to sell them on patents, but saying, we're just going to handle the European part of it. Did you have in mind who you needed to meet? Like, do I need to meet IP, in-house IP counsel? Do I need to meet law firm attorneys who can recommend me?
We initially thought it would be US law firms, but we found them quite resistant at the start, I think because of this potential competitiveness in their mind.
Yeah.
So actually our first clients were all in-house departments.
Okay. And you literally called?
One was a cold call. Maybe not a cold, maybe I met, I remember meeting them, I think they were here for autumn or something. They were in Raleigh for autumn.
Okay.
And I remember just, but it was a cold kind of connection.
Yeah.
And then, our first client down in Atlanta was, I think, just from a cold call.
Wow.
Like, hey, are you interested in doing, you know, European patents a different way? And us being an extension of your, I mean, we just took the playbook my dad had, which is you want us to be an extension of your in-house department and then we coined the kind of do everywhere in the world except the US. And the reason we did that was so that we would not scare off all the US lawyers.
People who don't do a lot of foreign prosecution, it can really grow very quickly. You know, you file one patent application in the US and then you decide, you know, I want to file it in 10 other jurisdictions. That turns into 10 office actions, you know, 10. There's a lot to keep up with, right? So for an in-house department, almost, it's, you know, they'd be kind of have to focus only on that.
Well, what we looked at very carefully, because at that point, PCT Filer had been around.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I went into the profession, we would do all the PCT national stages, the attorneys, I mean, mainly with your paralegals and all of that. But, we saw this, and again, Gordon Stark, who's still at Murgatroyd, he's heading up Murgatroyd. We would discuss this wave of commoditization that was coming across the industry.
Yeah.
And you could see it coming. You know, it started with CPA when they started doing renewals, which is what I do now.
Yeah.
And that took that out of the hands of attorneys. And then it moved into like PCT national stages. That came out. Then it was EP validations. Attorneys used to do that as well.
Yeah.
That came out of their hands. So you saw these services starting to appear, and we knew we needed to compete.
Yeah.
So one of the remits once we got up and running in the States was, let's build a solution for Americans that could compete with PCT Filer, that became Inovia. That was a really interesting time. What we offered was a lawyer-led solution to something that was coming anyway.
Yeah.
But we just had to make sure we did it in a way that could compete.
You're succeeding in the US, and then you became a CEO in 2014. Did you have any kind of vision? What was your kind of dream for Murgatroyd, or were you going to kind of just ride the wave?
No vision. I feel, you know, my wife always laughs because she'll say, you've never got a lack of ideas, just time and money. You know, I'm the first to tell you, I'm a horrible implementer.
Yeah.
So I need to have teams of people around me. And, you know, I was very fortunate at Murgatroyd. We had Gordon Stark, who was an amazing right-hand man, because he would make sure that the ideas I had became reality. But I had a really strong vision for what I wanted Murgatroyd to be. And I think we got really far down the road with that, which was a global... I think I had in my office, I had this sign that just said global leader of IP.
Yeah.
And every day, and, you know, I would do a lot of work on, you know, our values and, you know... I really, really wanted us to be an awesome solution.
Yeah.
But falling back on customer service, so we were doing it really well, and being lawyers that people like to work with. And that can be all sorts of things, you know, because, you know, it just depends which lawyer and who the client is. Some clients never want to speak to their lawyer. They just want to email them. So it's meeting the client where they are and making sure that we offered that awesome solution.
You know, you became a CEO, but I'm guessing that was kind of a natural transition at that point, you being there?
You know, for me it was. There was internal resistance to it. But, you know, ultimately we viewed it as we need to look after our family asset.
Yeah.
Why would we put anyone else in
internal resistance by, like, attorneys who've been there a long time?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like, oh, just because your name. I think actually, not speaking out of school, and I know exactly who I'm talking about, I think it actually got reported back to me. One of the directors had said, well, we can't all of the last name Murgatroyd. Fine. Look, I get it, right? I get it. It should be fairer than that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we had a very solid answer, which was, well, next time you invest the money and take the risks, then you can run the firm.
Yeah.
But at that point, we had everything of our family asset was rolled into this one business.
Yeah.
So, you know, that wasn't the case for these people who could leave and go to a competitor or something.
Yeah.
It was a bit of handcuffs at that point, because it's not like I could go and get a job elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, like this was where I was going to be working.
Yeah.
So if I was going to be working there, am I going to be happy? Are we as a Murgatroyd family going to be happy with someone else running it?
Yeah.
You know, I think ultimately, if I look back, that's probably why I'm not there anymore. You know, which is when we finally did go private again.
Yeah.
I think that just wasn't really for me.
Yeah.
Honestly.
And maybe we'll talk about that. Obviously, so you were public for a long time. And then in 2019, it was publicly reported, Murgatroyd was acquired for 63 million euros. By Sovereign Capital, which is a private equity firm, from what I understand. How did that come about?
I'm limited in what I can say, but I'm happy to tell you what my own feelings are about the matter. Probably the best way to put it is, if we had to go back, would we do it again?
Yeah.
No, we wouldn't have sold. There was a lot of family things that wouldn't be reported, is that my mother had Alzheimer's. And our family was going through a very difficult period where my father did not want to put her into care.
Yeah.
So he was looking after her at home.
Yeah.
And it really wore on him and the family. And of course, everyone who, and so many families deal with Alzheimer's, but that kind of long goodbye, the you know, very sad nature of it, really put my dad into a, my mum and dad were a very strong team, and it put him into a very stressed position. If I am going to be generous, I'll say that an opportunity was presented to him. If I were to be less generous, I would say that he was taken advantage of at that period. You know, I think somebody said, you know, when I complained about it after the event, you know, some said, oh, go cry into your bank account. Now, that completely, if anyone thinks that that actually, that the money was the driving factor, then they completely misjudge the Murgatroyd family. It was my father's baby. It would be like putting a value on your sibling. That wasn't the reason that we did it. In retrospect, I wish I'd left on the day that we sold.
What was the pitch? Maybe not the specific, but what is the pitch like a private equity company give to somebody that is that?
You know, interestingly, I don't know exactly where they came from. I wish I did, but they appeared on the scene by some of the other board members, I believe. I actually don't know. We did get pitched, you know, and I met them. And what I discovered was that, and, you know, a good friend of mine at the time, not in the industry, said, Ed, you know, you do know how private equity works, right? But I was naive. I was naive and I was uneducated on what all of that was. Looking back, I would have taken a lot more of what they said with a pinch of salt, as they say.
Obviously, you stayed on as a CEO for 3 years, so I think...
Well, I only actually stayed on for 6 months.
Was that part of that understanding that you would stay on for longer?
I actually, in retrospect, this isn't what I felt at the time, but in retrospect, I think probably from day one, they knew that they just wanted... They were really worried that when you do a public to private, you can't really announce anything until it's done. And I think they were very worried there'd be an exodus of attorneys or whatever. So they wanted me, they told me my goal was to keep everyone there and happy and all that. And I actually stayed wanting to do that. I was putting my heart and soul into it. I thought, well, okay, this is the new chapter. But it became quite obvious fairly quickly that those things they told me before the sale were not necessarily the things that were going to happen.
What is it that private equity firms do, I guess, who haven't talked to your friend, I guess? What did he...
Well, he just said, you know, they have one goal in mind. And, you know, not to blanket, broad brush an entire industry, because this is only the private equity I knew. So so I don't want to say anything else. And I feel that it's totally reasonable that they have one objective in mind. You know, they're money people who come in, they buy assets, they buy and build, or they blow up bits, and, you know, that's what they do. And then they sell it again. So their objective is to take it from A to B and sell it. That was never my objective at Murgatroyd. My objective was to grow us so that we could offer more services and be more awesome and be the IP leader in the world. So there was this clash that happened. I think fortunately for me, we, because it was a public to private, they were, the private equity is much more used to kind of doing management buyouts, that type of thing, where they can negotiate with you. But they couldn't pre-negotiate anything with me, because it's not allowed for a public company to pre-negotiate anything. So quite quickly after they sent, I remember receiving the first, you know, contract after the deal was done, and just being like, I immediately knew at that point that this was going to be challenging. Because, you know, I went from like a 5-page patent attorney contract to like, I might misstate this, but I feel like it was like 100 pages or something, something along those lines. But I did try and stick in with it. And then COVID happened. But we had a tremendous year that year. Like when I remember the day that our results came out internally, and I was waiting, because I mean, we'd grown it. I think it was like 30% or something, COVID aside. And I never got a call from anyone. Nobody. The owners didn't speak. And then I thought, oh, something's going on here.
Yeah.
Something is up for sure. So it really unraveled very quickly after that.
Yeah.
And I decided this was not for me. And they decided I was not for them at the same time, you know?
Yeah. No, I'm sure that was hard. You said, you know, you saw that you're being your whole life at that point. Before with that, one thing that I did, what, you know, very interesting about mortgage rate story, I guess maybe it's something that you do have in common with their mindset now, is acquiring other law firms, right? You said your reason, I think, probably was different from their reasons. Yours was to service clients. Their reason was to grow the asset. But what did you learn from that? I'm sure some acquisitions worked well, some didn't. What did you learn from that? Any that stand out?
Acquisitions are challenging because you're, you know, there's certain duplicated...
Or mergers, sometimes they call
mergers,
them.
Mergers, yeah. I would say all of ours were acquisitions as opposed to mergers.
Yeah.
They always brought excitement because there's new people, there's new things. It was always very hard to keep our culture the dominant culture because, you know, we believed in our culture. My dad had a great way of doing that, which was on day one, everything in the new firm got replaced. Yeah. Like all the computers were brand new, all the signage was brand new, everything down to the pads and paper.
How did you convince these firms to be acquired?
As a public company, I've looked at accounts of so many firms around the entire globe because people would approach the public company saying, because it's a very easy way to raise capital.
Okay.
So they would send their, like, hey, and you could rule out, we had what was called the acquisition checklist. It was a 10-point list. And most firms that approached us didn't get past point two.
Yeah, so it was a way for these firms to kind of solve the problem that your dad by public list.
But more easily because we could purchase them. What we weren't really that interested in doing was just buying clients.
Yeah.
We wanted to buy talent on the attorney side because attorneys were still in high demand. They still are, but you know, there just was very few of them. So if they didn't have, so a very common scenario, Eli, would be a firm would come and say, we've got three senior partners who are still practicing and they're in their 80s. And we'd say, well, obviously you'll leave when you get your check. So what are you selling us? Oh, we've got this great client. Don't you think that client will probably leave when you leave? Like, and who are the people you brought up through the business?
Yeah.
Nobody. And so that was point two, you know. And so we were never interested in those. Where we got interested was when there was a whole array of different qualified people. We were quite interested if they had certain bits where we had automated it, say, national phase filings, and they were maybe outsourcing national phase filings.
Okay.
So that was something we could immediately take in-house and boost our revenue and offer better service, hopefully, to the clients that we were buying with that firm. There was a multitude of different reasons why we bought. One, we bought because we wanted to enter a market.
Yeah.
You know, that was the French one. We wanted to more... bolster that market. But we really did have this belief in the States that here, we didn't need to buy clients in Europe. But so our acquisitions kind of went down at that point because we were putting the money into organically growing in the States with sales and marketing efforts. So we didn't really feel we had to do so many acquisitions at that point.
Any lessons about why some worked out well and some didn't after you made the decision to acquire?
Yeah,
for others,
some did not work out well.
Yeah.
You know, some key people would leave.
Okay.
Or honestly, I've probably never been asked that. It's a really good question. And I do know what the answer is. There's one or two where ultimately the clients left and we didn't even know they were leaving. They just, if you looked back at the acquisition and you're like, you know, 5 years ago, here's the client list.
Yeah.
How many of these do we still have?
Okay.
I think we did that one time, me and Gordon, and we were like, shoot.
Yeah.
Like, not all of them, like a lot of them left.
Yeah.
And we didn't really know. It wasn't like a definitive moment.
Right.
So I would say, and why? Because you build relationships with your attorney.
Yeah.
And when your attorney is different or there's a different culture, you've probably already chosen to go with that firm for some reason.
Yeah.
The fact they became another firm is actually a problem.
Yeah.
You know, because in some cases, some of the attorneys that were coming back had been at Murgatroyd and had left for all sorts of reasons, gone to that firm and then were back. So you can imagine they didn't last very long because they're like, I already decided I didn't want to work here. So they would be off.
I mean, I'm guessing you have to talk to the clients, right, to figure out if that's going to be something.
You do, but you do try to do that. But as you know, the clients are very attached to their attorneys.
Yeah, yeah. No, I understand. I guess my point is when you're going through that acquisition, that's part of it, figuring out is that a relationship that's going to last.
You do try. Well, here was an interesting thing that we would do. I don't think this is confidential, but when we would get past the 10-part list, and we'd be like, okay, and we would sign NDAs and we would get their client list. We immediately discounted their biggest client because we just assumed they might leave.
Yeah.
So we can't do the deal based on, I remember one was a massive electronics company from Japan.
Yeah.
If they left, if they went out the door, this business would be worth nothing.
Yeah.
So that's how we would value it. We'd look at all the costs and what were known costs that would be saved, like outside financial people and all sorts of things. But if the numbers worked out right, that's where we would get to our number that we would say, this is what we think your business is worth.
All right. So I want to make sure to get to talk about Hexus IP. You know, I think when we talked last, I told you, I remember when I was first trained as a patent attorney at the big firm, they said, all right, when we get this patent allowed, first thing we do is we tell the client to use CPA and they'll pay the maintenance fees because they don't want the headache. In the US, they're called maintenance fees, but in Europe and elsewhere, they're called annuities and renewals. And it's, I think, more complicated abroad. But you actually told me something interesting that a lot of European firms actually like to handle that. Now you're just focused on the annuities and renewals at Hexus IP. Can you tell us the whole story about why did you decide to just focus on that?
Yeah, and I feel like, we could fill podcast full of intrigue about bits of our industry, but this was a particular when I left Murgatroyd, me and my father sat down and we're like, you know, we had been very fortunate to, we did get a big check when we left. As I say, I don't think we'd do it again, but this was the situation we found ourselves in, and we decided, are we just going to go into like real estate, or are we going to do, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Both of us are like, no, we love our industry. Yeah. We've spent our whole careers in it. So my father, you know, in the time at Murgatroyd, me and my father actually seed funded another startup renewals business called Envoy at the time, with a chap called David Kennedy. And he built that, a modern approach. And we loved that because CPA, we'd had a very rocky relationship with CPA.
Yeah.
I can't go into all, but maybe over a beer. But we didn't like them. I just don't know how to say it. So we did a lot of it in-house at Murgatroyd ourselves. But there were some challenges. So me and my father decided which part of the IP industry is ready for a new way of thinking.
And that company that you funded, does it still exist?
Or? No, CPA bought it.
Okay, I see.
But at that point, actually, we seed funded it and then he bought us out and very shortly after sold to, he kind of merged with someone else and became delegate and then CPA bought them. So, which tends to be a theme, just so you know, with renewals providers, they get bought up. We're not the only people doing this, doing an alternative to the big behemoths that do these. But, and I won't lie, CPA did an amazing job at convincing all the lawyers that they couldn't do renewals.
In Europe as well, or in the US?
No, this was a US-specific thing for whatever reason.
Yeah, yeah.
They convinced all the senior partners that the risk profile was too high.
Right.
Anyone who knows anything about what we do knows that, yes, it's risky, but it's only risky if you think you're going to mess it up.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got a good system in place and you've got a good, even a subcontractor, this is what I never quite, this is what we're offering.
Well, I guess part of the thinking is there's the risk, but what is the reward, right? If you get a few hundred dollars or whatever it is, it doesn't seem like a lot, but obviously it's a different mindset for you.
No, yeah. Luke, listen, it's, I understand it. As yeah, I said, it was genius. Yeah. CPA did a good job. They decided that this was going to be their ploy, and it worked. Yeah. Where we're coming in now is saying, okay, well, that's all fine. We're going to offer a solution for customers, either that the law firms hand over, yeah, like you were saying, you know, it gets granted, now what? Instead of just sending it CPA, because I would argue that a client doesn't really see the difference. They will still blame you if that goes awry.
Yeah.
They will still blame you for putting them with, why are you not doing that? You know, CPA misses a payment. Yeah. They will still blame you. Yeah. Right? I mean, rightly or wrongly. And I'm not saying that they would be able to sue you or anything, but they'll still blame you. But what we're trying to offer is just a modern alternative,
yeah,
to what's been done before. Look, at the end of the day, there's a date something needs to be paid. It used to be just two big books my dad would talk about. There was one big journal book with renewals to be paid in date order, and each day you fold it over. And then once it was paid, you put it into the new book for the next one.
Yeah.
You know, at its essence, it's so basic.
Yeah.
You're just trying to make a payment to a government, the right amount, on the right day, and we're great. So there is, of course, complexity in how that all happens. But I think we've come up with a really good solution. Tech-enabled would be the right word.
Yeah.
We've got a great, because, you know, just like I said at Murgatroyd, customer service for me is number one.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's where people really see the benefit at Hexos. You know, they get great pricing. Yes. So we went with a flat pricing model.
That's a cool part. You know, you don't see a lot of people in our industry. You go on their website and they tell you exactly how much.
Hey, I'll tell you, $25 for a US, $75 for an international.
Yeah.
You know, we're very happy with that. We also leverage our agent relationships around the world.
Yeah.
What came out, though, after, so being at this at 3.5 years, and that lovely wee product, and it's a lot of word of mouth. You know, our big clients were, and we're winning big clients now, but it's been from word of mouth, is that we decided very early that we were going to make sure that our docket system that we use for just renewals and that the client can see is a sterile environment, kind of like accounting software. We will not put a date in there that has not been validated around the world, like in whichever country. It's quite eye-opening to see when portfolios come across out of docket systems, like the big docket systems you would imagine, how many errors there are.
And you mean validated in terms of having the software to make sure that it makes sense?
Where we can, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
If we can, we literally, there's one in an African one we just did where they literally, the attorney there, we said, can you walk down to the patent office and check? Because there was no other way to do it, right? So, and we've negotiated with all our agents to do that as part of the onboarding for free.
Yeah.
So when you work with Hexos, you know that the data that you're looking at on the tech, that's been validated. Like, this is the real deal. We have to say no a lot, I've discovered as well, which is people are like, oh, can you just expand your docket or can you interact your docket with ours? Absolutely not, because there's too much data clash. Now, we do, of course, report back when we get a difference. We'll say, hey, there was this case and, you know, that actually was not paid 4 years ago. I don't know why you're still wanting us to pay it.
Yeah.
But that's become a very critical sales point for us, which is we're going to make sure everything is accurate. The data is accurate.
What has it been like building this company and selling your new business, your new disruptive startup versus selling Murgatroyd, which was this established European firm?
You know, it was a similar mindset, because when I came here, I used to call it, I said, it's a startup mindset here, even though we were based, we had this backing, startup mindset. So it's the same. I love it. Absolutely love it. I mean, I love taking an idea, putting it in the ground and seeing something real come out. It's sort of the closest I get to building something. I think I wanted to be an architect, truth be told.
Yeah.
But I love that feeling of something real. When our first software got delivered, I was beside myself with joy. Because it's like something that was in my mind is now a functioning thing that is helping people to pay whatever it is. I mean, it's it's not going to change the world, you know, but I hope that the way that I interact with people and treat people changes the world. You know, this is just something that I know about and I want to do better.
What about the business development aspect? Do you think it's easier to convince them to sign up for Hexas or the...
Oh, definitely.
Okay, yeah.
But at the same time, I've been here for so many. I've been here for 17 years now. Yeah. Kent, who you mentioned earlier, Kent was with me at Murgatroyd and he came across a year ago. He's now just, he's just about to come out as non-competes, which is awesome when that happens. But so it's been a little slow for his purposes until November 6th or something. I can't remember. He'll tell you the date, but we are counting it down. But it's been much easier because just
he's getting all
our
this
networks.
Fun stuff he wants to do.
Yes. Well, I don't know if I'd call. He's doing his MBA. Yeah, I don't know if I'd call that fun stuff, but fun to watch, but probably not fun to do.
You know, there's an interesting part to this is that you talked about the commoditization of the business. Clients have been thinking a lot about legal costs, but one area of it they haven't thought about seems to be, at least, is annuities and renewals, right? You know, they kind of just go with the flow, even though they're trying to, you know, get their lawyers to be like, reduce the by a few hundred dollars. I mean, what is the advice that you give for clients about both for law firms and services like yours in terms of thinking about their legal spend? In my opinion, the fair price. You know, you could always find somebody cheaper, but it might be worse.
Well, how should in-house people view it? Well, firstly, if you're just looking at annuities, we start there. These are big ticket items on the budget line. I mean, these are running into the millions, multi-millions a year to make these fees. So when, you know, there's some very baseline questions you can ask. And that's something that we do. We usually get the quote from the competitor as they're moving to us. And we cross compare and they're sometimes they're, hey, they're not that far off. Sometimes they are dramatically far off.
Yeah.
You know, where it's transformational for the budget line item. So just keeping and knowing the right questions to ask, you know, one of the things I love mentoring companies as well. So that's something I do. I love just making sure they're all really aware there's no black box. You know, people like to think that IP is in this black box, renewals, and nobody knows what happens in it. You just you write checks and throw money in and hope that your patents stay on the other side. Well, let's demystify it a little bit. It's not that. We can tell you exactly and show you on the portal. You will see how much it costs and where the money's going and what it's doing. So that's one side. On the legal spend side, yes, it's expensive, but you know, the best clients I ever had were the ones that had been sued or had sued. Because suddenly you realize if you don't have any IP, if you've got no cards in your hand, when that competitor comes knocking, hey, you're infringing us, you have nothing, right? Or, I mean, you can flip it aside and be, you know, you can. It doesn't matter if you're patentee or you're potential infringer. The advice that you get from your patent attorneys and even on the prep and pros side is so critical and valuable. Yeah. So, yes, there's always going to be that push on costs always. So that's why I think it's important that any of these commoditized spaces that we do look at sensible ways to offer US firms ways that they can compete in those areas. And I'm not just talking renewals, I'm talking about any of them. This is why I came up with the PCT national stage, because you need to give your clients something, right? I used to call things that attorneys could only do, I would call those gold jobs, right? Save it for the gold jobs, you know, like if you're going to spend money, spend it on that attorney time reviewing something or it's worth its weight in gold, literally.
I hear a lot of stories. I think you mentioned Australia about, you know, these publicly owned firms, but really it's non-attorney ownership of law firms. But I'm hearing stories from Australia and Canada where attorneys have gone through it. And their experience a lot of time is a lot of what I guess the experience you went through private equity where, you know, they're sold all these things And then once it actually happens, it's way worse. And they're looking, either they're just getting through it or they're thinking about, is there anything I can go back to what I was doing? Why do you think that is? Non-attorney ownership of law firms turns into that.
I've given it a heck of a lot of thought over the years. I really have. I think the overarching opinion I have come to is it is very much dependent on who's pulling the strings.
Yeah.
It actually doesn't matter per se. You know, if we were a publicly traded company, who was pulling the strings? Me and my father.
Yeah.
Right? We were pulling the strings because we owned effective control. So who's controlling things? You know, I know Andrew Blattman, he's the head of IPH, the one down in, you know, and if he's pulling the strings, he's a patent attorney.
Yeah.
Right? So it's is the person pulling the strings got the resolve to fight against the lure of the money people and the owners? Now, we had owners ask us things, you know, and I remember having conversations where it would be, well, no, we can't do that either ethically or, you know, normally that was to do with conflicts, honestly. Yeah. Like, it would just be like, well, no, we can't do that. Yeah. And they would say, but surely, because it's worth, you know, no, but we just can't act for them, right? So that's how I would distill it down. I would put it with a warning for any firm looking at it. Be careful. You know, things that you get told when they're writing the check might not be how that transpires once they're pulling the strings. So it's who is pulling the strings. That's the way I've distilled it down.
So it doesn't really matter the legal structure. If it could be a publicly listed company and it worked out well, it's really who's pulling the strings. The U.S., I think maybe with a few exceptions, some states, is just you can't have non-attorney ownership of law firms. Two questions about that. What do you think as the legal profession? Should they allow it for the benefits that you described, public list and so forth? And also, I guess it's a related question is, if you do have these mega law firms, and I think they've taken over Australia and Canada, can lawyer-owned firms still compete in those markets? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, what I can tell you about some of the Australian firms is the ones that are not owned externally, if you put it that way, very much sell the fact that they are attorney-owned and independent.
Yeah.
Right? Now, why is that about such a sales point? It's because no client, let's put it this way. If I were an internal counsel or I owned a large company using an outside law firm, I personally wouldn't use one that was not owned by lawyers. So, you know, I just think that there's a clash. There's a clash there between, you know, lawyers have to walk the line every day between what they can do, they can't do, what they can say, they can't do, they can say this, that, there's discovery, there's also... Money people are not like that. They're not held to those... They have their own kind of... Well, one might add some of like hedge funds. Are they even held to account? And what I would ask myself if I were a in-house counsel going to a firm that was not owned by the lawyers is, who do I complain to? Who gets brought to task if you do something unethical?
Yeah.
Who, because I can tell you it's not easy to determine who actually owns some of these companies.
Yeah.
You know, who is it that you actually bring to the table? Well, is it the lawyer? Maybe, but they're just a paid employee.
Yeah.
The difference between that and bringing a senior partner who is the owner and a partner in the business and has got legal liability. So that's where I would put it. It's a confusing area. I know there are some firms starting to pop up. I think it's one in Arizona or something. And I would put it back to, it's not a blanket no way.
Yeah.
but absolutely drill down who's pulling the strings. Who is deciding on the pricing? Who is deciding which clients you might take on other than me that would be in a competitive situation? And what pressures will you be put under as a lawyer by those outside parties? Because they're not under the same obligations.
You know, you've had a lot of success with business development in the U.S. You told a story. Anything from that, any wisdom that you can share, you know, maybe to an attorney who's just starting out there and trying to figure out business development about what can they do to have a sliver of the success that you've had?
And, you know, a lot of us are fairly introverted. You know, some of, you know, there's some that are extroverted, but there's a lot of attorneys that are fairly introverted. They like sitting. You've got to be somewhat happy with your own time to be a patent attorney. But really just getting out there, be yourself. Be that lawyer that people want to be around, and that will get you through. You know, people want to be able to pick up the phone. I mean, one of my own pet peeves is never create barriers to your client. One of the biggest barriers I've always found in accountancy, for example, or lawyers I use for other things, you pick up the phone and you get like a bill like within a week for like a call. Like half the call I'm Scottish, I get a chat, you know, half the call I'm talking about their kids. You know, I should have, I joked with my friend and said, I should take a double cappuccino and then be really rude and just be like, when they answer the phone, just be like, tell me the answer to this, because that will keep it short. Yeah. But, you know, just persevere, you know, be yourself, always be yourself. And some clients that will resonate with and some it won't, but it's a big world out there. So, you know, the people that it doesn't resonate with, you know, move on. And there will be someone out there who resonates with the way you do business and how you hold yourself. And I think it shines through for me if somebody's not being their authentic self. You can just tell. Yeah. They're putting on a show. So for me, it's be yourself, trust, and have faith that will be sufficient, and try to keep your overheads low. You know, work from home. Yeah. I don't know. Don't sign a 15-year lease, yeah, on a big building, you know?
Yeah, a lesson that a lot of firms have learned over the last few years. Any final thoughts, anything else that you want people to know about Murgatroyd Hexos?
Thank you for having me on. And Harity is obviously our leading the way in a lot of these things, and you personally with your podcast, you know, these are helpful. Hopefully if anyone found anything I said helpful, I am always happy to chat or mentor or give advice if it's helpful. And I also love to hear advice from other people, so you know, feel free to reach out and get in touch.
Great. What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Definitely from hexosip.com.
Okay, great. All right, well, thank you so much for doing this. It was great to talk to you again.
Thanks, Eli. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8, the voice of IP. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating in your favorite podcatcher. We'd also like to thank Harity & Harity LLP for their generous support. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. And don't forget to check out our full archive of past episodes. Clause 8 is a Brouhaha audio production. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.